All right. Started. The issues are there if you don't have them. And if you have them on your computer, please refresh your browser, because the first time I put them up, one set of issues hadn't come in yet, and another set had come in, but I'd somehow missed them. So the very latest version only went up today, which has lots and lots of them. And I'm not going to actually go over the ones that are listed PYS for previous year's students, because for once we got a whole lot of real students who are still around to contribute issues, and therefore I suspect we're going to have enough from those. So let us start with one that is from CP, and see if CP would like to tell us to raise the issue and discuss what has to be suggested about it. Is there a CP in the room? There is not a CP in the room. In that case, I think I've got the next one. No, I don't have the next one. The next one is L.Y., who is... there you go. Hi. Let's see. L.Y. I also don't see. All these invisible people. All right, let us go on to who is next in our list of malefactors. Is P or PH, not exactly malefactors, people who had ideas. And let's figure out. There's PH, right, of course.
Some parents will be eager to give their children drugs that increase intelligence. Presumably, my drugs that reliably increase intelligence would be expensive, at least initially. Thus, it is likely schools located in healthier areas where parents can afford the drugs will have higher test scores. How might an education system that bases allocation of funds at least partially on test scores accommodate this type of disparities?
Yeah, to begin with, my guess is that the first people who get them won't be people whose parents are rich, but people whose parents are educated and following literature and such, and therefore will correctly guess what to give their kids before it's official as it was. If that doesn't affect your argument, it's just... I'm wondering, is this really any different from what already exists? What is the biggest determinant of K-12 educational outcomes?
I would assume parental involvement.
You got it. I believe that's correct. I'm pretty sure those statistical studies, characteristics of sort of your home and parents, are more important than anything else. So in that sense, you're getting the effect already, and you can't easily tell if that's genetic or environmental. What's going on is that the kids who are smart parents are smarter, whether it's going on the kids who are raised with books and interest in stuff and so forth end up better anything, whatever is going on. So, but in any case, what are the present allocation rules? I thought the present thing was more, in what sense the test scores determine present allocation?
So the Obama administration is they turn things, at least for the teachers, and if anyone knows more than I do, at least for teachers, they've made it more competitive. So test scores are important for teachers, at least, as well. And I think that there are funds that certain schools are only eligible for when they reach a certain level of test scores.
Are they eligible for those funds if they've had that level of test scores in the past, or is it only a reward for getting up to it?
I think that once you reach that level, you are eligible for that. And so if you then fall below that level, I think you don't get it. I know I've been teaching in a local high school that I do not reach those scores, and they just talk about how you are doomed to never reach that if you didn't initially. And so I think that one of the solutions, I suppose, would be all the kids the drugs were on a...
That's sort of silly, though. You might want to give all the kids drugs if the drugs do good things, but if the only reason is to change the allocation of money, it would make more sense to change the allocation of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that after I submitted this, I realized that to a certain degree it does, because I think allocation of funds is also just largely tied to poverty tax, right?
That used to be the case, but I thought that quite a long time ago there were legal changes such that states... we're shifting it from depending on local property taxes to something more nearly statewide. So I'm not sure, but my casual impression is that like 40 or 50 years ago, expenditure per pupil tended to be much higher and better off school districts, but I thought that that was not true. Now, it may still be true de facto. The point that I've seen made in a discussion of this is that even if you're spending the same amount of money, that the parent, sort of educated, well-off parents are in a much better position to pressure the system. And part of pressuring the system is getting the bad teacher sent somewhere else. And therefore, and I think this was an argument that was made by a public school teacher who was saying that basically you end up with the worst teachers in the worst areas and the best teachers in the best areas, which seems plausible.
And I also think one of the ways that they do this is so you just account somehow for this factor, just where a school has more children, that somehow you gather data and you somehow account for that, but then this is a privacy issue. Like, are these parents going to be willing to reveal what medications their children are on? Are they required to use?
But the other thing is that presumably the point of this kind of a rule, if you look at it, is to reward schools for doing a good job of teaching kids.
Right.
And this is really, in a sense, the same problem I might have already discussed in the law school context. Namely, how do you measure how good a law school is? Well, yes, Stanford gets all the people pass the bar, but they happen to have gone past the bar, they never gone to law school. Exaggerating a little bit. And so it's the same issue of how you measure value added. And you could imagine if that was what you wanted to do, having something like information about parental background, and to say that getting kids from a good background up to a certain level is less evidence the school is good than if they're starting at a lower point, but how likely that is happening. But,
all right, well, since we have L.Y. back with us, why don't you start on your first issue at the top of it, which is the happy drug is or machine is invented. Are you not already addicted to happiness?
Yes, we are. And then, so, the other side might argue it's like a game machine that kids are addicted to the game or computer.
Can you define addiction to for me?
Yeah, it's always addicting,
right? What does addiction mean? Am I addicted to breathing, for example? Terrible things, like terrible side effects if I stop breathing. Is that an addiction?
I will argue it is not addiction. Addiction, I think, is something that you can live without, but choose not to.
How then am I addicted to being married to my wife? I'm very fond of my wife. We've been happily married for like 25, 28 years, something like that. Get along very well. Is that an addiction? I could leave her. I could, you know, if she was run over by a bus tomorrow, which I hope will not happen, I would still survive, though I wouldn't be very happy about it. But does that count as addiction? I choose not to leave her, even though divorce law is so easy, I suppose I could if I wanted to. I want to know what addiction means, because it's central, it seems to me, to a number of these questions. And when you say addiction itself is a reason to make something illegal, then I want to know whether you're going to make it illegal to stay married to the same person, to do anything you want to do. How do you distinguish addiction from the fact that I like doing this, I keep like doing it, and so forth?
Okay. Maybe I see your argument. I guess
Can anybody tell me what is the content in saying this is a bad thing because it's addictive? What's the underlying argument? Yeah?
I mean, I think this connotation is like using excess because it has bad consequences.
I don't think so. That is to say, there are surely lots of non-addictive things which used in excess have bad consequences, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying that if you're addicted to smoking cigarettes, you're going to get lung cancer.
But the fact that you have lung cancer has nothing to do with being addictive. Those are two separate issues, right? You could have it happens that nicotine is addictive, but you could have an entirely non-addictive thing, which gave you lung cancer, right? And anesthesis is addictive, but it seems to cause cancer.
But I'm just saying the addiction of being addicted to cigarettes would lead to...
But I want to know what addicted means. If addiction is an argument, then you have to figure out how or if at all can you distinguish being addicted to something and really choosing to consume it, use it, whatever. What's the difference? Did they say? Yeah.
I think the bad consequences are part of it, I think. And I also think the lack of choice. So it's not that you choose to do something that's bad for you. It is you have relinquish control and not relinquish
So I'm addicted to breathing.
Where are the bad consequences of breathing, though? If we're tying it somehow.
So you're saying you can only be addicted to something that has bad consequences?
I think that addiction arises, or that you would point out that someone is addicted to something, only when there are those bad consequences, right? I doubt that we would say you're addicted to writing, you're addicted to...
You'll say people are addicted to the internet, they're addicted to computer games.
It's true.
It's certainly true that when you say something that's called an addiction, you're at least suggesting that you disapprove of it, right. But I'm not sure if that's what the word means. Anybody? Yep.
I think it's the lack of willpower or self-control or self-direction. It's it being enslaved to something else. So in that sense, you probably could be addicted to, not chemically, but...
But then nobody's addicted to cigarettes, because we know that people sometimes quit cigarettes.
Yeah, it's not impossible to quit addiction.
So
you can always escape slavery. You can always run for the Underground Railroad.
So then how do you distinguish between saying I'm addicted to saying something and saying I like it? You say there's no choice, but then you say there is choice. I don't know I'm not sure I know the right answer. This is sort of a puzzle in that sense. It's just that the concept turns up a lot in these contexts. And it seems to be particularly problematic if you talk about being addicted to happiness. Because on the one hand, you could certainly say, well, yes, given that they've got a machine that makes them happy, they keep going back to it. And yet, sure, but people also keep going back to playing, games they like, interacting with people they like, all sorts of things which they do because they make them happy. We don't usually think of that as an addiction. All right, why don't we go on then to your next one, since we've got it in order.
Yes. Steroid. Steroid, legal one. Every athlete is on steroids. Would that be easier for all athletes? Then take that.
Let's take that one first, because you really have two different things here.
Okay.
So, what about athletes who choose not to take steroids? There are an awful lot of things that are legal that I don't do. It would be legal for me to get drunk every night.
They will be in decisions, right?
Yeah, so then they're at a disadvantage in playing against those who choose to use steroids.
The decision not to do this themselves, it's the athlete's decision not to work out more, it's the athlete's decision not to take specialized training.
It's the athlete's decision at the moment to obey the law by not using steroids, as opposed to other athletes' decisions to violate the law by taking steroids. That it seems to me that the argument against steroids is an argument against steroids. One argument is that it's unfair competition with the dead. That is to say that we've got records and that therefore it's unfair for today's athletes to have this advantage over past athletes of the records. Another argument is to say that the steroids are bad for you and if it's legal, almost everybody will take it, but then they'll die earlier or something.
Why do you want to compete with the dead? They're already dead.
Well, we had a discussion this last time, and I gathered that beating records is something that people value a lot. It's sort of a cheating way of doing it. You have available things they don't. Although, of course, they already have available things they don't, because they have, better baseball bats, probably, and other things. Let's go on to another one from PH.
Is it possible widespread use of mind drugs will stunt evolution of the human mind?
Do we have evidence that the human mind is evolving?
So that is what I was thinking, and I'm not sure that we've taken ourselves out of that evolutionary cycle at this point.
We haven't taken ourselves out of the evolutionary cycle, but that doesn't tell us what we're evolving for.
So I suppose it kind of depends on what you think of evolution. I think that our basic knowledge has increased, certainly, and our capability, our capacity.
But none of that has to do with the mind evolving. So that's cultural accumulation, though.
So that is something I...
In order for the mind to evolve, which I assume you mean for people to get innately smarter, genetically smarter, what condition would have to exist for that to occur? That you seem to be talking as if evolution is sort of an automatic shift to the good, whatever the good is, but evolution is a much more precise concept.
We need that intellect.
I don't know what need that intellect means. What condition has to be true in order for evolution to raise IQs? Very simple question. Nobody want to answer it?
Selection.
Which? which means what has to be true in order that evolution by itself will raise IQs. One set should do it. What?
Smarter people or people with greater intelligence.
Yep.
Kids.
Right. It's got to lead to reproductive success.
So
that's not the same thing as if we've got to need it. It's not the same thing as... All right, it's a very, very simple concept.
So I'm regretting deleting, presumably, our minds are still evolving from that before I submitted it.
Yes.
But that is kind of what I was getting at, though. In a world where everyone, like, presumably intelligence is a trait that helps you attract mate.
It's not clear. That is, you could argue that the fact that humans are the only intelligent species, apparently, probably, is evidence that in most environments, intelligence beyond whatever the existing species has is not an asset for reproduction. And you can even raise the question of whether intelligence is an asset for humans. There's this argument that people have been making, somewhat over 100 years, I guess, which goes along with the idea of eugenics. And the argument people make is to say, look, it's the poor, stupid people who have lots of babies because they don't have enough sense to keep down their reproduction, whereas the wise, educated, well-off people only have a kid or two because they're busy reading Shakespeare instead of having sex, or they're having sex, they know about contraception. Therefore, people have been worrying for, say, about 100 years that humanity is going to go downhill, it's going to breed intelligence out of the race. I don't think there's much evidence that it's true, but it's not logically impossible. Because you could certainly imagine environments where intelligence resulted in less reproductive success rather than more. What's the evidence against that claim?
That we're getting dumber.
Do any of you know about the Flynn effect?
No.
Oh, this is one of the great puzzles. A fellow, I think Australian psychologist called Flynn, for some reason, I don't know what, decided to try to estimate IQs through time I think he had good data back to about 1930 and some data back further. And what he was using was, in addition to IQ tests, there were a variety of other psychological tests that correlate pretty well with IQ tests. And so he had data on those as well. And he got a very surprising result, which was that measured IQ has been going up. And it's been going up as long as we have records, as I say, this one was like 70 or 80 years, at what I would say is an implausibly high rate. That is, if you believe Flynn's results, I don't remember the exact numbers, but let me guess that in 1930, the mean IQ was 15 points lower than it is now. It's that kind of scale. And if you think about what that means, that would mean that if you go very far back, there would be almost nobody we would consider smart, and a whole lot of people we consider almost retarded. That doesn't fit what we know about past cultures. So that's why it's a puzzle. That is, that it seems to me that if the apparent empirical results of Flynn got it right, then David Ricardo and Gauss and a whole lot of other people couldn't have existed. These are people who, as far as we can tell, are as smart as anybody is now. And now one possibility is that for some odd reason, the upper end of the tail stayed the same, and it's just that the bottom end got stupider. But then again, could you really have a functioning 19th century society if the average person had an IQ of 8? It's hard to believe that you could have it. And so I think Flynn's view, as far as I can tell, is that some specialized subset of intelligence that's measured by IQ tests has been going up for some reason, maybe in our society, results in more... I think his view, I think, is not genetic at all. My impression is that he thinks it's more like that the modern environment somehow encourages certain kinds of intellectual ability, and that those show up on IQ tests. But in any case, but it's worth at least realizing that this puzzle exists in the data, because it's an intriguing puzzle. As to both why it's happening and how you make it consistent with the fact that people weren't really dumb 100 years ago as far as we can tell. Maybe they were. Maybe I'm just reading too much into the...
Yeah, it's an interesting point, considering we've got a lot more going on in the modern world, it seems like. Maybe just all the simulation. I've heard that active memory, just new simulation, everything like that, it actually does help to increase.
Well, that's the sort of the argument.
Well, I'm sorry. Also, today we know how to educate kids better.
Do we? Is there any evidence for that?
The information.
We spend a whole lot more per kid, and as far as I can tell, our results in standardized tests from about 1960 to 1980 went down.
Okay.
And it's stayed about constant since 1980.
That doesn't mean that the kids are not learning. They, doesn't mean that they're more less like intelligent in all the fields.
All I'm saying is, what is the evidence to believe that we know more about people, about how to educate people, than we did 50 or 100 years ago?
For example, today, right?
What?
For example, when we're raising kids today, we have all this information online about how to raise a kid. What's the better way?
So we know whether the information is true? Say, excuse me, you judge technologies by their output. If you really learn to be better at making computers, you make better computers cheaper. We sure have learned that. If we've really learned to be better at educating people, we ought to be able to educate kids better for less. And as far as I can know, it hasn't happened.
Well, we did know something, for example, we didn't know how much, like, what kind of food you eat to the kids before, what kind of food is good, what's nutritious, what's not nutritious. But today, we know. And at what stage, what month, the kids need to eat what kind of food.
I think you're too optimistic about our knowledge. What I remember is being told for 20 years that in order to avoid heart attacks, you should eat margarine instead of butter, and then discovering that was precisely the opposite, almost precisely the opposite of the correct advice. So, anyway, but now some IQ measurements or some proxies for IQ can be taken very young. I think there are things like eye response rates in babies and such. So that would be hard to interpret that way, but I just don't know the evidence well enough to know if I don't have that data going back far enough to tell you. But So let's go back to your original question.
Right.
Because what are the circumstances? Suppose it were true that intelligence was an unambiguous evolutionary advantage. All right? I'm not convinced it is. Suppose it were. In that case, everybody takes mind drugs. Everybody pushes his IQ up by 15 points. Why doesn't intelligence need to go up?
I'm sorry. So I think that what I would—I didn't frame this right.
Yep.
But let's say it brings everybody up to the same level, right?
So, why would it do that?
Because this is the hypothetical drug we use, and it brings everyone to the same level, regardless of where you were before. And so now what you've done is effectively just mask that desirable trait.
Wait, is the same level the level above what anybody had before, or are you bringing down some people? If it's above what anybody had before, I have to see the problem.
Right. Let's just say it's above what anyone had before, because then you are masking that trait, essentially, right? The intelligence. And so where intelligence once was a desirable trait that could evolve, now you... There's no way to discern someone when you're trying to select a mate who's more intelligent than the...
Because they are more intelligent.
What's that?
Because it's not, you can't discern, it's no longer true.
Right. And so now you've just kind of taken evolution out, and I suppose now we are permanently hooked on this drug, or the second the human race goes off of it, now where are we? We're just going to be...
Wouldn't we be where we started if we stopped using that drug?
I guess, but what I mean is, after a few generations or after hundreds of years where everybody has been mating and reproducing without any regard for intelligence as a desirable trait, because everybody's so intelligent, and now you come off of it.
Why would the distribution have changed? Since IQ is now irrelevant to reproductive success, why would it go either up or down? Yep.
I think what Pat's saying is, like, if I wanted to have a child that was, like, had blonde hair, and so I could make that blonde hair, but she was dyeing her blonde.
Yep.
So then, like, the kid turns out to not be, like,
But a blonde hair dye works just as well as being natural blonde. Why do you care that your kid isn't naturally blonde?
But it's just a natural, like, what they would have to rely on the codes, basically, to stay smart, right?
Right. That's kind of what I was getting at. You just made yourself reliant on this.
But before you had the drug, you relied on the drug to stay smart. Yeah, too, and so if you didn't have the drug, so you weren't smart.
So now, if you just go off the drugs, now I suppose now everyone might just be on the same.
Why would they be on the same level? Whatever genetic characteristics cause the variation before the drug, they're still going to be there, aren't they?
What I'm saying is that variety, like whereas an intelligent mate may look for that, a more intelligent person may look for a more intelligent mate rather than someone not as intelligent. And so now, where everyone's as intelligent, somebody whose genetic makeup still contains something that would have high intelligence may give somebody of lower intelligence. You
right.
Mean
I think I see. So your argument is that what maintains the existing distribution is some level of selective mating. and that just balances the recursion to the mean phenomenon, which otherwise tends to result in smart people having, you know, smarter than average people having less smart, dumber than average people having smarter kids. I guess the reason I find it hard to see your question is very interesting is that it takes for granted a human environment that's stable for hundreds of years, which strikes me as phenomenally unlikely.
You didn't finish your point.
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I went through for a lot of weeks discussion, but one thing that I think that Pat, that I find interesting about what Pat is saying is somebody, in a sense, mimicking what it sounds like intelligence because they're taking a drug and it's not actually their natural intelligence. Am I understanding that correctly? Is that it kind of makes me think of My Fair Lady, and the concept that sometimes the way people treat you necessarily might on its own naturally increase your intelligence. That was just a comment.
Are you bothered by the fact that a significant minority of Americans would suffer from vitamin D deficiency for racial reasons if we didn't have vitamin D fortified them?
Am I bothered by that?
Yeah, you're aware of the fact.
I am now.
People from sub-Saharan Africa are adapted to an environment with a lot of sunlight. And an environment with a lot of sunlight, the body doesn't have to produce as much vitamin D. So the result, as I understand it, is that somebody, all of whose ancestry is from sub-Saharan Africa, who lives in America or Europe without vitamin D supplementation, suffers from vitamin D deficiency. This is an invisible fact, but everybody gets vitamin D supplementation. So is that a problem? Is that any more? If that's not a problem, why is it a problem that in your hypothetical future, some people wouldn't be smart except for taking the medicine that everybody's taking?
Well, it doesn't bother me. What I'm talking about is meeting in the middle, right? And where there is a distribution now, and what does that do to...
But that distribution doesn't seem to matter in your story, because in your story, genetic IQ has no effect on actual IQ, right? Because the drug, by your account, makes everybody equally smart.
I was trying to get at the idea of just the evolution of the human species, right? And I did make a presumption, or rather an assumption, that it would be acceptable to expand our intelligence or our mental capacity. And I think that my drugs, in masking that trait,
why is it more desirable to do it by genes rather than mind drugs? Isn't what matters how smart people are, not why?
Okay, so what I'm saying is, sorry, I think that the point is moot at this point, but what I was saying is, if that drug then ceases to exist at some point, for whatever reason, now you've just stunted evolution, essentially, right? The evolution of mankind, I guess. And it just struck me as an interesting thought.
I suppose. So you could argue that this phenomenon has already happened in lots of other contexts. That, for example, physical strength is surely much less important now than it was 500 years ago, because we have automobiles and, you know, all sorts of other things. We have weapons that don't require as much force as an axe or a sword would, and so forth and so on. And so it might be a case, I don't know, there may have been some. A few hundred years isn't very long in terms of human evolution because we have such long generations, right. But still, there may well have been some effects along those lines. But if the technological change means that what used to be a useful characteristic no longer matters very much, right?
Right. So I think that part of what makes this maybe not as interesting is that the chances of that drug vanishing are very slim. I guess it would have to be an apocalypse scenario almost, in which case we're probably not going to do
or else then we then back and we then start evolving and become a drug, right, in that account.
But I think, yes, to your point, I do think it's a really interesting question. I think evolution will change, and smarter people won't necessarily be those that are naturally smart, they'll be those that respond differently to drugs. Like you saw with baseball, basically everybody was on steroids, but still. Certain people responded much better. I don't know if they're the dose, but certainly very large, significantly larger than most people.
Right.
More generally, though, what's true is that evolution isn't towards the good. Evolution is towards those characteristics in a particular environment result in reproductive success. And our technology certainly changes what those characteristics are. that my guess would be, for example, that the fact that we now have safe cesarean sections means that the disadvantage to a woman of having narrow hips is less than it was 200 years ago, and that you would die when you tried to bear a child. And I would expect that if that condition existed for long enough, since I gather women's hips are wider than optimal, hip running doesn't matter for my either. I think women's hips are wider than optimal for running because they've got to be wide enough to allow the baby out through the pelvis. And that's less of a constraint. There are all sorts of other ways, presumably resistance to any disease that we've wiped out no longer matters. And resistance to diseases that can be treated with antibiotics doesn't matter nearly as much as it would. So you would think that as the environment changes in all sorts of different ways, the evolutionary pressure is going to change. I just think that it's going to be slow enough. It's going to be a while before we notice any effects. Anyway, let's go on. We've got lots and lots of interesting questions, so we should focus on just one. And I think you're our next person.
My question. So right now, most people submit to drug testing only when they're required to. But I wanted to imagine a situation where performance-enhancing drugs became so widespread that those people that weren't taking them under sort of validation.
Yeah, would approve it. Yeah, that's interesting.
And so because they're...
Especially likely, if you imagine, for only to expand on your story, that the drugs have some negative side effects, not catastrophic, that therefore there's a reason why you aren't going to take them all the time. If you take them all the time, then we don't really care, and therefore what we're worried about is people who take the drug for a test. Right? Is that a plausible version of your story? And then continue.
So, given that the person is submitting to this voluntary drug testing, what are privacy implications? And second question, if the government discovers that you don't have, let's say, Adderall in your system, but you have been using a different illegal drug, can they charge you with a crime for that?
Yeah. Let's give you the first part is an interesting and plausible story that you want to be able to prove it. In a way, it's analogous to a case that exists now, and that's the question of AIDS testing. And I don't know what the current institutions are, but you can certainly see that there are reasons why people might want to have a believable test result which said, I do not have AIDS. You want to have sex with somebody or other transmittable diseases, for that matter. And I don't know whether that actually exists as a common institution or not. I certainly see the suggestion. At the moment, what are the obligations? Suppose it's privately done. What are the range of circumstances in which a private party is obligated to report evidence of something illegal? My understanding is that a physician who observes evidence of child abuse is legally required to report it. What about a physician who observes evidence that somebody's using an illegal drug? Is he legally required to report it?
I don't think so.
You think not? You think that's physician-patient confidence? Just as a lawyer, right, under most circumstances. When is a lawyer required to report evidence, to report the fact that you know something illegal is happening? You know? You ought to know. You don't know, because I'm sure there are probably legal and ethical.
Ongoing. The privilege only extends, I think, more like
but if somebody comes to you and says, I've committed the following crime, and I would like legal advice on what I ought to do now,
you don't have to report it.
You don't have to report it. But what if he says, I'm thinking of committing a crime, now do you have to report it to prevent it?
No, you can't report it.
You can't report it.
Yeah, you can advise him to not.
Uh-huh.
Of things.
Right. So then it seems to me that one possible resolution to your situation is that the testing is done by a physician, the physician has patient privileges, and so the testing bodies guarantee to you that they won't report illegal drugs. Is there a problem with that solution? Legal problem? Practical problem?
I'm wondering how this might relate. I think that there's a rule in emergency room that somebody's admitted with a gunshot wound, that they have to, that there has to be some sort of reporting mechanism. I don't know, I necessarily know what the patient's name is attached, but I imagine that reporting would be somewhat pointless if there was no connection made.
Yeah.
But that might have the same
That's interesting. Yeah.
underlying purpose as, say, child abuse. but it also seems a little bit closer to the drug testing.
So basically what we're saying is that we know that there are some circumstances in which professionals are, and some in which they are not, and some in which they're supposed not to report such things. So then the question is whether your hypothetical testing people can get themselves covered under the kind of rule which says that they can guarantee not to report anything else.
In all those scenarios, it seemed that the professional was acting in his or her professional capacity.
We just have
the doctor. The doctor was giving medical treatment.
Right.
The lawyer was giving legal advice. But here they're just testing.
But that is their professional capacity, is to tell you, it is to report on whether or not you're using a certain drug. But in any case, look, suppose the law is they've got to report it. Then what's the obvious solution? The obvious solution is people who are making test kits to design a test kit. They will only report whether you're using the particular thing and won't be sensitive to other things. So it seems to me it only really becomes a problem if you imagine, as you well could, a big push on illegal drugs. And so they change the law to say these existing testing people have to report it. And that you could imagine that.
I was thinking you have a subset of people that are not only aren't taking Adderall, but they were very clean in general. And so they would actually want a testing service that provided a full panel.
Anybody know if any of that now exists? Suppose I want to go to an employer, and suppose, I don't know, I guess employers are allowed to require drug testing for employment in general. Suppose I want to go to an employer that doesn't require it. But I say to myself, he'll more likely to hire me if he knows that I don't use drugs. Are there private facilities which I can go to which will believably testify that I don't use any? Nobody knows.
I think you can go to a doctor and ask him to test you, and that doctor will
put that right. Yeah. But you don't know of any actual sort of established institutions for the purpose. Interesting question. All right, I think we are back with PH with a different kind of interesting question.
So you had addressed this in the book as well, but how might contract law accommodate a world where mind control drugs are common? Would contract language alone be sufficient to avoid contracts entered into involuntarily? Where a person alleges the other party drugged them to a disagreement, should there be a presumption of a mind unaffected by drugs?
What are the plausible legal scenarios in this world?
So I think one of the ones brought in the book was mandatory drug testing almost for entering into a contract.
So one possibility is if then we take mandatory. Suppose there is no presumption that you were drug free when you signed the contract. In that case, no contract without testing would be binding,
right?
Because somebody can always claim he was drugged. And in that case, if you want a contract to be binding, you're going to have both parties be blood tested at the point when they're signing the contract.
Right.
Are there other plausible options?
The other one, I guess, this isn't plausible to me, is what I was asking. Would contract language alone be sufficient? And I think the answer is no.
What do you mean by contract language?
Contract language where a clause saying if one of these parties is discovered later to be under the mind control drugs, whatever it may be, then this contract is void. But you assume that if one of these parties is under these, that clause is not going to be in the contract, right? That the party inducing them into signing this terrible contract.
Unless it's in an order to persuade third parties, maybe. But in any case, it seems you have to think about whether or not the fact of having been under the drug is going to be demonstrable later. If it's not demonstrable later, then it seems to me, then either people have to have ways of taking precautions so they don't get the drug, or you have to say that you have to retest it for compliance. If it is going to be demonstrable later, then all you have to do is to say that if you were under the drug, it's not a binding contract.
Just a third party, maybe, that's just witnessing the whole process. Yes. Also, drug tests, you assume. I think that the presumption of a mind unaffected by drugs might be a presumption. Either way, is pretty harsh, I think, because a presumption of someone that's drugged, say if there's not a clause, a boilerplate clause in there that says there are no drugs, I suppose then it would be fair. have a presumption that mind control drugs were used, and now you have the party that benefits disproportionately has to prove otherwise. And I think that presumption is there. A presumption of a mind unaffected by drugs, though, just seems really harsh to me. For whatever reason, I don't know if anyone has any take on this.
Yeah, it does seem that a lot of it is going to depend on the technology, on whether or not it's possible to demonstrate. And if there are good mind control drugs and no good way of making sure nobody's fed you one, and you can't demonstrate it, then it looks as though the only viable arrangement is to say you have to get tested for the contract to be viable, to be binding. And once you drop those assumptions, now you have a good chance to lose.
The next one
is
mine as well.
Right. That was sort of fun.
If one party to a contract gives the other mind control drugs to induce agreement, and the effects of the drugs are permanent or ongoing, such that the drug party will not challenge the contract.
Right.
Should third parties be permitted to bring suit to void the contract? Could tort law accommodate this and provide relief for family members or others affected by such a contract?
Is this really a new issue? I'm going to claim this is an issue which has got to have been litigated hundreds or thousands of times, just with slightly different technology, yes?
Sounds like self-defense, like you can defend someone else, is like they're going to beat up.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it's self-defense. I was thinking of, I think it's improper influence or something. All of the cases where you have an elderly wealthy person who leaves his wealth to the nurse or to his new girlfriend or to somebody who then the other putative heirs claim sort of brainwashed him into it. Isn't that
third party in regular contracts? Is it because what I'm talking about, generally the people that will bring suit for that, they need to prove that they were somehow going to benefit beforehand.
Right.
So here, let's say it's just my father was drugged and he lost a lot of money, and this is when I'm still dependent on him as a kid, so I suppose I do show that I am not benefiting from this, and I probably could still have standing. It's interesting because I think it would just bring up standing issues completely, because then is that enough to have a child of somebody that was really damaged by one of these contracts?
And what about the state maybe enforcing it, by some statute saying, an attorney general will somehow, if they had evidence that one party used these drugs, we think this is bad policy and therefore will ensue.
I don't know. Maybe before we try to make the drug itself illegal, obviously, it's hard to enforce. You're raising an interesting question, but it does seem to me that in the context, especially of inheritance, but I'm sure there must be ones that aren't really inheritance, ones where the old person has given away something to somebody, and then the putative heirs claim he shouldn't have given it away, he should have left it to us, and it was only due to undue influence. But there is a sense in which you could argue that if you think about falling in love, that's sort of the same technology, right? That you decide you really value this person because they want to do nice things for the person, and you want to keep doing nice things. And suing to take back the valuable thing you gave the person isn't a nice thing. Right? So there's a certain sense in which this is imitating stuff we already do through conventional means, but the only form I think in which you're ever going to persuade a court is when the person is old, or almost the only form, right? Because we suspect that old people may not have full use of their faculties, and therefore that, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure that if a 40-year-old, wealthy person falls in love with a 20-year-old woman and agrees to write her to leave all his money to her, I don't think his kids are going to have any luck trying to argue undue influence, are they?
Unless he was like mentally incompetent in some way.
We don't have the relevant drugs now. Right. So, all right, let me go on. I've got a couple of related ones of mine, which struck me as interesting. It may be illegal for a man to have sex with a woman who is drunk, even if she voluntarily chose to get drunk, on the theory that once under the influence, she is incapable of giving consent. How would similar issues be dealt with for other sorts of drugs? Suppose we have a drug that makes someone fall in love. What about a real aphrodisiac? Right? The distinction is, I'm thinking of an aphrodisiac makes you want to have sex, whereas fall in love makes you fall in love with a particular person. Someone under such a drug may be able to think clearly, unlike someone who is drunk, but the thinking will be within the context established by the drug. So any opinion? There is apparently some very weak evidence for human pheromones. The pheromones are chemicals that for some animals actually have large sexual effects, by which we're attracting mates for insects and things. And I gather there's some evidence. I'm suspicious because it makes such a good story that even with not very good evidence, somebody would claim it, but there purports to be evidence that you can get very small effects of that sort for humans to observe.
Have you ever read the book by Roald Dahl?
What's the book?
I think it's called The Switch Bitch.
No.
It's about how they invented pheromone. They went around and like had this use a bunch of like famous like intellectuals, musicians, and confiscated their sperm.
Weird.
There's actually a series. No, it is
not. It's not what?
Because Roald Dahl wrote a number of children's
books, yes, right.
But the rest of his mostly dealing, I think he just wrote a series that dealt with this man that invented this love potion and went around the world, first trying to seduce every woman he could find, and then I guess this other one is about trying to rock it off.
Yeah, the other way around, though. What we're doing, seducing. Yeah. Yes, well, certainly that's something that people have, you know, daydreamed about for a long time. I think I mentioned in the book that Orlando Furioso, where you've got these fountains that make people fall in love with, of course, one of the three kinds of magic fountains make you fall in love with the first living creature. It doesn't even have to be human, as I remember, that you see. But that's a plot device, basically.
Would this drug be, like, FDA approved or anything like that? That's kind of one thing that I've wondered, because...
That's an interesting question. And I don't know. Suppose you have drugs which do not claim to cure any disease. Because my impression is that currently, I think we said before, a good deal of the distinction between a drug and a dietary supplement, whatever the term is for them, is whether they claim to cure a disease. So a drug that makes you want to have sex, that's not curing a disease. Right? I suppose a sex therapist say curing, you know, virginity or impotence or something, but you could imagine ones where that wasn't what was going on.
Cures, like, among consent.
It's not usually through disease, though. My next one, which is a version of the same question. Perfumes claim to make the wearer... Note, by the way, that any example involving sex gets more attention from an audience, including students and other ones. And there are good evolutionary reasons for this. Since we are selected for reproductive success, we are also designed to pay attention to things that have to do with reproduction. That, I think, is at least a plausible account of why. I have a comment somewhere in one of my economics books that when psychologists want to get attention, they talk about sex. When economists want to get attention, they talk about the income distribution. That's sort of a similar question. Everybody has the same opinion about sex because they're not getting enough of the right kind, and everybody has the same opinion about the income distribution, which is other people have too much money and I have too little. So it involves your audience very much. Perfumes claim to make the wearer more attractive to the opposite sex. What if we develop improved versions that actually work and work well? So this is, again, I'm thinking, again, you've heard about a variety of things, and I'm thinking less of an aphrodisiac which makes somebody else want to have sex than of something which has the same effect as a man having a very muscular physique or a woman, you know, looking really sexy, whatever the things are that make somebody say, well, I'm going to have sex, this is the person I want to have sex with, so to speak. So imagine that we have something like that. What legal restrictions, if any, might be imposed on their use? Is this any different from a man who makes himself attractive by driving a Porsche or a woman who dresses well and uses makeup? Or I could have said a man who exercises a lot and has a handsome physique.
I grew up in Utah, yep. A very conservative place.
Yes.
And I could see if these truly did work very well, these being banned in certain counties in Utah.
These being what?
The pheromones that work very well, perfumes or whatever, yep. Banned in certain counties potentially. Maybe just in public, the way you have dry counties all over Utah. see them being banned in certain areas at the very conservative places.
So I was actually thinking about schools, them being banned in schools,
yeah.
Because you know, high school in particular,
yes,
disruptive to be in much.
Yep.
I can see conservative limit on their use in certain conservative states. Like, I'm assuming there's a perfume for him and her, and imagine he puts the perfume for her on him.
And schools, oh, that would be a different one, yeah, but schools,
yeah.
Schools do have restrictions on clothing, depending on the school, but there are schools where there are dress codes, and presumably part of that dress code is targeted at people trying to dress things that they think will make, wear things that they think make them look attractive to the opposite sex. Well, I expect a lot of it is also targeted at unrelated things like, you know, gang colors or seeming to impress members of your own sex with how, you know, fashionable you are or something. Let's see, our next one is, I think, our still absent CP. So we'll skip over that for the moment. Since we've got a lot of questions, we may or may not come back to it. All right, we have now another one from L.Y. And you are raising altering personality questions.
If we can't alter their personality, then we don't have a say or regulation on that.
What about children getting, what about parents getting their kids to alter their personality? There must be an awful lot of parents who wish their kids were different in some way. Well, we're doing it already, though. That is, after all, one of the major forms of drugging. If you think of drugging to deal with ADHD, all right, that's...
Are there presently regulations on say, sex change operations beyond just, you know, the surgical, whatever, that this needs to be carried out by a professional?
There has been discussion, at least in England, of sex change stuff fairly young. And I don't know what finally ended up happening. I remember seeing some news story where it was claimed that it was, I don't know, a 10-year-old or something. And I'm not sure if they're actually talking about doing an operation or if it was somebody who felt him or herself to be of the opposite sex from the physical body. And I think there was some talk of maybe it was hormones or doing something that was intended to make it easier to eventually have a sex change operation. So that would be... Yeah, are there any effective limits on parents drugging their kids at the moment?
I think the limit comes from the doctor.
Then you have prescription requirements for the drugs.
Yeah.
Right. So then, if there were personality change drugs under current law, presumably, if the parents could get a doctor to prescribe it, as I say, it seems to me that that's what whatever that stuff is that they give for ADHD is. But it's not a permanent. Maybe you might want to make a distinction between permanent and temporary. You might want to have few restrictions on things that only changed your personality while you were taking them, and larger restrictions on permanent changes. But of course, you could also imagine a government which approved of those personality changing drugs that changed personalities in ways the government approved of. You know, make you more submissive to authority or something, and disapproved of ones that changed in the opposite direction. All right, I think we are now back with DE.
So not to dodge the question, but actually it touches on maybe two questions now.
It touches on a number of interesting questions. Why don't you read it first, and then I'll give you my initial
So scientists have recently discovered that a common beta blocker, a drug that's been prescribed in hypertension, can actually make people less racist. Could drugs like these, or improved versions, be mandated as part of sentencing for people convicted of, for example, a racially motivated hate crime? Assuming the side effects were minimal, could the government justify requiring that all people are required to take such drug to promote a more tolerant society? And should such drugs be required or allowed in prison population?
starting with your first sentence, do you know what the actual experiment was? That is, when you say scientists, my instant response to scientists have recently discovered that is not to believe it.
So
can you describe the actual results?
So the drug, I haven't read the study itself, but the drug itself is propranolol. So
sure, but what was the evidence that it reduced racism?
Fear response. So it's actually, it affects the fear response in people.
But that was the explanation, that was somebody's explanation of why it might reduce racism. What's the evidence that it reduces racism?
I haven't read the study.
The problem, the initial problem is, what does racism mean? And if you actually read, if you follow up the news stories, the study, the full study, I couldn't get out of production, but I could read the summary version of it. What they're doing is a test, which I know about because I took it online because I was curious, which is supposed to be measuring your unconscious association between race and favorable or unfavorable things. And the form of the test is, you're supposed to have one finger on a key on the right side of the keyboard and one on the left. And they show you a series of pictures of faces. And they tell you, if the face looks Afro-American, push the left key. If it looks European, push the right key. They do that. And some of the faces, pretty obviously one or the other. They then do the same thing, but now it's words, and it's good or bad. So laughter is good, evil is bad, and so forth. Then they run it through with pairs, where if what you see is either an Afro-American face or a good word, push the left key. If it's either a European face or a bad word, push the right key. Then they do the same thing, switching the associations. I assume, although they don't explain this, that what's going on is that they think that if you associate Afro-American appearance with bad things, that will make it easier and you'll react faster when it's paired that way. Whereas if you associate Afro-American with good things, then the pairing Afro-American bad will seem confusing to you and you'll be slower. They don't explain how they do it. But so describing these as reducing racism is quite a stretch. And I think what the researchers say they're doing is measuring something like unconscious racial bias, I don't remember, or racial association or some term like that, which is a bit better. Sample size is 18 of each of two groups of 18. I couldn't find anything that said what the actual statistics were. One of the news stories, if it had been true, would have implied exactly the opposite of what was being claimed. Because one of the news stories claimed that the result was people who took the drug got a negative result on the test, which would mean they were biased in favor of Afro-Americans. Well, that's racial prejudice too, but I don't think it's true. As far as I can tell from the other stories, what the real result was, that the people who took the drug had a lower bias against Afro-Americans in terms of this association test than those. I think that's what happened. But it's worth checking. It doesn't matter really for your question, but in terms of one's view of reality, given that any purported scientific result that's newsworthy is likely to get reported independent of whether there's any good reason to think it's true, it's worth trying to follow it up. And one of the wonderful things about the times we're now living in is you can do it because of the internet, whereas that would have been a real pain even 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, probably would have been hard. So anyway, but now let's get off the science and ask the real question. So the question is, suppose we had a drug which somehow reduced racial prejudice, or reduce maybe unconscious racial prejudice. I should say their result was that conscious prejudice was not affected. But they had some questions which we asked you, you know, do you feel, how warm or cold do you feel towards this racial group? And a few questions. And apparently those results were not affected by the thing. It was all the unconscious. So suppose we have that drug. Is it legitimate to require everybody to take it?
It's feeling?
Yep.
So that is a very noble cause, but I really am not comfortable with the government basically trying to change the way that we think.
Is it even a noble cause?
Well,
for a moment, what they're reducing, after all, is not a statement of behavior. What they're reducing is the mental characteristic of having positive or negative responses to particular racial groups. Well, it's not obvious that having positive results to people like you is a bad thing. You know, maybe that results in useful forms of social solidarity or something. I don't know if that's a good argument or not, but the point I wanted to make is that that everybody sort of takes it for granted in asking questions like this, that we know what the good thing is. But it's not always that obvious what in this case, when you're talking about fairly subtle mental characteristics, or putting it differently, maybe the real characteristic is the characteristic of being afraid of the different. And maybe that's a desirable characteristic. It happens to be undesirable if the difference is a form of difference that's irrelevant whether you should be afraid of. But if you think more generally, you say, well, look, what I'm familiar with, and therefore you're afraid of it. It hasn't bit me yet. But that animal there, I don't know what it is. You know, maybe it's really dangerous, whereas, you know, cats and dogs, I'm familiar with it. So anyway, so your response is even if it's a good result, you shouldn't do it. Well, and my response is, how do you know whether it's a good result?
Yeah, in this case, it's sort of easy to get those calls. Racism is bad, you know, but I'm just still not comfortable, I think, with the government legislating how you think.
But notice here that all of these news stories are using racism in an extraordinarily inflated sense. And I should say, maybe it's just a matter of age. I find the way the term racism is used routinely to be objectionable. Because to me, racism means hating people because of their race. But it has become, at the best, to mean having some racial prejudice. And frequently having different views about race than whoever is applying the label. So that I'm pretty sure that if somebody gave perfectly objective evidence showing some racial difference between people, that would get labeled racism. Even if, you know, the evidence supported it, and even if there was no evidence of hate or whatever. So, anyway. So what's your opinion? It's your question.
I don't think the government should be able to do that.
How about to either the next part of yours? How about?
I think most likely would be maybe the prison population. Stretch.
But surely we've got much less fancy drugs, and we give them tranquilizers, right? If you're worried about keeping down prison violence and are willing to drug the prisoners, if many people are, surely we've got drugs that, you know, make people less violent, less lots of things.
Sure. I think it's a balance of benefit versus how much you change the actual person. You can completely incapacitate the person, but I think these drugs, in my understanding, they don't actually do that. Majority of senior citizens take some sort of hypertension drug. And so even though there will be side effects, it will probably be minimal. So
really a side effect. It seems to me that his point, in a sense, is more interesting. Namely, in what sense is it legitimate for governments to try to change people, even prisoners? And if it is there a distinction in a different way? Think about the history of penal practices. That you basically get a shift in England and I think in America, sort of at the end of the 18th century into the 19th century, away from punishment and towards rehabilitation. Now, not necessarily a positive one from the standpoint of the prisoner, because what that means is things like solitary confinement, on the theory that somehow you'll repent of your sins when you're not associated with other bad people, preaching at you, Bible reading, teaching you a trade. There are a whole bunch of things that are happening, at least in England in the early 19th century, which all reflect the idea that we can fix criminals. Whereas, as far as I can tell, the dominant view in the 18th century is much more nearly, yeah, the reason the guy stole was it was a good way of getting money, so if he will steal, punish them for stealing. How happy are people? A, then one way is, can you do it? And I think the answer on the past evidence is probably not. Maybe we'll be able to with better technologies. And how happy are people with the general idea that an appropriate part of the penal system is changing people? Think of those two models. One of the models is to say the reason we lock you up is either to keep you away from other people or to make the bad thing you did unprofitable so you won't, and people like you won't do it in the future. And a different model is to say the reason we lock you up is to give us an opportunity to re-educate you, to order you in ways.
Yep. So, well, this kind of, in a way, really ties in with one of my questions later, which was about a drug to, remove sexual desire,
right,
and sexual deviance,
right,
and molestation. I think it's interesting that, obviously, as you said, one of the goals is rehabilitation, and of course we have, this popped in my mind, we have Megan's Law, which requires, people released from prison after serving their term who have been convicted of child molestation to register, notify, whatever.
I think it's much broader than child molestation.
Okay, yeah, I am not exactly sure of it, but what pops into my mind is, well, they we do that because we assume there's a high probability that they'll recommit, in which case they're not rehabilitated, in which case why would they release in the first place if that's one of the goals of punishment.
But that last point raises a very important point about these different philosophies, and that is that if your view is that the function of the penal system is to re-educate people, then in principle there is no relationship between the seriousness of the crime and the length of the sentence. And in principle you could say, well look, all he did was steal a nickel. But the reason we've got him locked up is not to punish him for stealing a nickel, it's to make him somebody who won't steal. And sorry, he's been in for 20 years, and our tests show he can still steal when he gets out, so probably keep him in for another 10 years. I mean, that's one of the downsides, in a sense, of that, of what seems, in one sense, to be a more humane view of it, is that it's also an unlimited claim. Because you're thinking of him not as an equal of yours who only has a debt to pay, but rather as a subject of yours who you are to remold. And that's, you know, in certain ways, a scary kind of approach. Let's keep doing, because you had several related ones. Actually, we just skipped over, though, one, which is the one that we skipped over. AB, who is there, right? You're AB. That's what I thought you were. So, you want to do your question? It was really the same cluster of issues.
It's actually just the same question. I was just thinking of when courts can mandate schizophrenics to take their medicine and everything, and they find in the interest.
But they only mandate that during the trial, right? Isn't that theory or not?
I mean, like people who were just at risk of themselves, they can mandate them to take their medication when they found that they should be in a mental hospital. So if that is because of a risk to their own safety or safety of other people around them, then maybe a drug like anti-violence or what any other kind of drug would make sense. I guess it's really whose interest is higher, mm-hmm. and how much it would change the personality. But besides that, it's pretty much the same question. I also was thinking about rehabilitation as a part of putting people in jail, and all the therapy programs that come along with incarceration made me think that a huge part of jail is trying to change people. So I wouldn't be surprised if these drugs ever came along if this would happen. And it relates to one of my questions below, which was who would be able to access the kind of drugs to change your personality? And I don't know if it would just be open to general commercial use for people to have loyalty in their pockets, but if it was only the government who could use it, that would also seem kind of unfair.
And I think in all of these, it's worth at least thinking about whether this is a temporary or permanent change. That you can sort of see the argument of saying, well, while you're being tried, we've got to keep you under a drug so that you can defend yourself. But that's rather different from saying, we can give you a drug such that you will be changed forever after. The other, you know,
I know that in most of these cases, like Cell, they dealt where there's a framework for when you can forcibly medicate somebody.
Yes.
For the most part, they can acquire the condition of probation when you take something. There's no problem with that.
Most of these
deal with pinning somebody down and injecting them with something, where they said they don't want to take it. They've tried a court order mandating them to take it. They can take it. And so in Cell, that they said, you can forego that framework completely if this person is dangerous. And you can drug them with almost, I mean, they didn't say any drug they want, but whatever a doctor says will make them not dangerous. And it seems like dangerousness is the dispositive factor.
And is that the only one, or are there, what about the case where somebody is crazy, is believed sufficiently crazy so he can't stand trial and you want to try him?
So roughly the framework is the treatment medically appropriate, necessary for the health and safety of the individual and others in light of less intrusive alternatives.
In light of less intrusive.
Less intrusive alternatives. And that's the framework that the Supreme Court presently uses for that, and I think you
for people in general or for people who are convicted of crimes?
All of these have been in prison cases, and the cell was somebody during the trial phase who hadn't been convicted yet. But generally, they're always in their most of everything before cells in the prison context. There have been some circuit court decisions in actual mental hospitals, and then what it mostly has to do with is actually the state's framework, what they have extended procedurally to these people, which have been protected through the 14th Amendment.
And so does cell ever contemplate the case of some part of the state saying, you haven't committed a crime, but here is the evidence that you were dangerous, and therefore you must be medicated?
No. I think that you couldn't just grab a person that's acting like a crazy person on the street and say they're medicated. There's not. It's paternalistic, but not to that degree.
It would seem that, I mean, in the case of the person who was on trial, or if not a prisoner, though, at least the person on trial would, in theory, have like a zealous advocate.
Yeah,
they're in prison, so maybe they're not, but someone should be representing them. I don't know.
Let's go on to, I think it's yours is the next one, I think.
Is this? Which one is
that? The MS, the mind drug?
Yeah, we're going to discuss the one about rehabilitation for sexual...
All right, that's all right. So I was thinking of going on to the
next one,
which is the United Nations threatening the world or something.
That say a mind drug could be delivered like in the water supply or sprayed on a population, could this be used if by the United Nations, let's say, there's a drug called Compassion and Cooperation, and in areas of the world where there's violent unrest or food aid's being delivered but it's a corrupt government or organized crime is not being distributed, and what legal protections could the international have to ensure dictators do not use the same technique to introduce loyalty drugs into their population.
Is there a good reason to assume the UN are the good guys?
No.
That is, what is the UN? Imagine a case where there is an independence movement in some country which, in some sense or other, is justified. But the government of that country has got a seat in the UN, they've got allies, and so forth and so on. It seems to me you can, as it were, equally well imagine the same story, except with the roles reversed. The part of the reason I'm reacting that way is that one of the things I was reading up on last quarter was Somalia. And the scholar who, as far as I can tell, knows more about Somalia than anywhere else alive clearly thinks the UN is the bad guys and Somalia not the good guys.
I don't know how you. I don't know how you have this international structure and have it. I mean, work in a conventional instance, and then have something like that.
But also, it's sort of hard to imagine how you're going to keep dictators from doing things to their population, given all the things we know stop dictators doing to their population. Except once in a while, when there are lots of countries with lots of airplanes and soldiers who will stop them, but that's a somewhat risky procedure.
Yeah, on your last, it's the loyalty drugs question. I mean, I think to some extent some dictators that are very persuasive don't even need loyalty drugs.
Yeah.
I think that's what
that's
makes
why
them so dangerous, because they're just so charismatic that they're able to get the loyalty of such a large majority, or at least enough majority of the population, to convince them to do terrible things.
I'm not sure it's limited to dictators, though. It seems to me that one of the sorting characteristics for successful politicians is being charismatic. That Nixon's great limitation was that he wasn't a good demagogue. He was a skillful politician. He was a bright guy, but he wasn't nearly as good as most of the competition is and making people like him, which is one of the real skills. Let's see. All right, you've got another suicide moment about the certain people.
Oh, yeah. I suppose mind drugs were available for those who were contemplating suicide, which removed negative emotion and allowed for a thoughtful, rational analysis of the decision. If this were available, should suicide and assisted suicide be legal? And should the state require the taking of this drug and an appropriate waiting period before allowing suicide?
So does this assume that suicide is illegal because it's not made in a thoughtful, rational decision?
I think that's the implicit assumption, right?
Yeah, I think because it's largely in the U.S., not legal, most people would assume, though, that you're not thinking in the right mind.
So the question is, why should it not be legal? And it seems right that you are making the assumption she describes, that people, that the reason it's not legal is the belief that it's being made for irrational, emotional reasons. I have a little bit of a problem with your eliminating negative emotions, but if you're only eliminating the negative emotions and keeping the positive emotions, aren't you biasing the choice?
Well, yeah. So, maybe the poor choice is a type of thing.
But the... Any opinions? I mean, there's a difference. There's part of the question is, are there or can there be or can we trust the government to have mechanisms for determining if people are being rational or not? Or putting it differently, if we really had good ways of doing this, shouldn't we make a requirement for voting too? Only allowed to vote when you're in a calm, rational state of mind, so we'll give you a drug that makes sure you're in a calm, rational state of mind. I mean, it's a neat idea, and I'm not sure, I don't know that it's wrong, but it does seem to me to raise a bunch of issues about.
But maybe it's better for society to allow, you know, people to commit suicide, even though this may have some negative consequences as well.
Doesn't just taking the drug require some amount of rational thought, though, that you might not be having ever known?
Well, but in his hypothetical, they won't let you commit suicide. That's assuming that one problem with all of this is it's very hard to prevent people from committing suicide if they want to. But if you imagine the case where people, for some reason, want assisted suicide, where they're sort of, you're a wimp and you can't get yourself to jump off a high window or something, but if a doctor will just give you an appropriate drug, you'd be willing to take it. So in order to get the doctor to do that, you've got to go through this procedure. So that's not now, even that's not clear to me how hard even in practice. I'm the only person I know who, in fact, pretty clearly did. And as far as I know, what she just did was she accumulated pain pills, and she had decided when she was going to die. And when she was actually took enough of them to be a lethal dose. And I suspect that's an option for an awful lot of people. But at least she told us when her drop dead thing was. And some of us came to this in the week before. But. Anyway, that was the cancer case. All right, I think we're out of time. Anyway, we haven't discussed all the questions, but then this was a good one where lots of people had questions.